Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
I think I'd rather hang myself than buy a refrigerator.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Hilary Busis.
And I'm Chris Murphy. And we're here to discuss the first four episodes of Netflix's Ripley.
Tom Ripley from New York. We met at Bob Delancey's place. It was years ago. What a coincidence.
And later, Dakota Fanning, who plays Marge Sherwood, will be stopping by to talk all about why she never quite liked Tom Ripley from the very beginning.
Unlike other episodes of Still Watching, where we go episode by episode, this time we're doing things a little bit differently because it's all currently bingeable on Netflix. You can watch all of Ripley right now if you want.
Ah, okay, so go do that. Now come back here.
Watch half, maybe.
Yes, no, please only watch half. We're going to be doing Ripley in two parts on the podcast. Today we're going to be talking about episodes 1 through 4. On Sunday we're going to drop part 2 of our special coverage, which is going to look at episodes 5 through 8.
So why did we want to cover this show? I mean, I think all three of us are fans of the 99 film, right?
Mm. I think that's the number one reason.
Yeah. Oh, deeply. Yeah.
I have read the book. I read it after I had seen the 1999 movie, which, I mean, Richard, in your review for this show, you call one of the best movies ever made.
I think so. I used to be kind of hesitant because it felt like recency bias, but it's been 25 years. Yeah. I think we're allowed to,
we can plant that flag
to call
down.
It. Yeah. It's a beautiful film, and I think that I went into this show curious because I like the world that Patricia Highsmith built, but also a little trepidatious because, I mean, just it's black and white. That's a marked difference from this lush, beautiful film. But the Andrew Scott casting also piqued my interest because he has had a very, I first became aware of him as a villain, like on Sherlock. And
yeah.
So this kind of seems like something of a return to that form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's another reason why we picked this show, because he's such an exciting actor right now and such having such a moment between all the strangers and going from, you know, hot Fleabag priest to, you know, very seriously in Oscar contention this year. And then to take this project on, which is such a beloved movie, it was a little bit like, is this a good idea? Like, to step into, you know, the shoes of Matt Damon, that's not an easy ask. So I do think the Andrew Scott of it all played a big part as to why we're interested in this series.
For sure. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I remember an interview with him where he said kind of point blank, there was a period in my career where I was only playing villains because he was also a bad guy in Spectre. And Sherlock,
course, right.
Sherlock was such, you know, a huge, like, zeitgeisty thing. And he was like, and I was like, oh, how come nobody will cast me as something else? And then, like, you know, he went on to be the hot priest on Fleabag. And that, I think, kind of changed his perception in a lot of places and, like, showed his range. And now, kind of, yeah, this does sort of feel like a return to those first really attention-grabbing roles that he had, you know, earlier in his career.
Yeah, and as someone who met him as Hot Priest, this was a, like, whoa. That was really, really crazy to see him be so mean.
Yes, who would suspect that a priest might have terrible ulterior motives?
Hillary, how dare
you? Yeah, I mean, I suppose another point of interest for the show is that it's written and directed by Steve Zaillian, who is this veteran screenwriter who he wrote Schindler's List, like, but he also has had an interesting career in television. I don't know. Did either of you watch The Night Of?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yeah. I really like that.
The Riz Ahmed's big show.
Yeah. And it's so moody and dark. And this Ripley kind of continues in that tradition. So that's why we chose to cover this show. And we're going to get into sort of more of the details of each episode. But let's do a quick recap first, kind of just covering what happened in the first four episodes of Ripley. Tom Ripley, as we know, is a grifter living in New York when he gets an opportunity to go to Italy to convince trust fund enthusiast Dickie Greenleaf to come home.
I don't suppose you have any vacation time coming up or a leave of absence.
To go there?
To talk to him face to face.
Of course, they take care of all your expenses in addition to a salary. That goes without saying.
Tom quickly makes friends with Dickie, moves into his Italian villa, but Dickie's girlfriend Marge is suspicious.
Everything about Tom is perfectly vague. Intentionally so, if you ask me. Or haven't you noticed? You say he's not a bad guy, but I don't like him.
After Tom is rumbled trying to extort more money from Dickie's father, Dickie tries to ditch Tom on a trip to a small Italian village, but instead gets a rowing oar to the head and dies. Tom Ripley tries to cover up the murder. He tells Marge that Dickie has gone to Rome and then assumes his identity.
Somehow, out of all my friends, you picked the right one to send. I love and miss you both. Richard.
I mean, at least in these first four episodes, like, it's kind of a procedural more than a psychological mood piece like the movie is.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this Ripley could have a not your mother's Ripley tagline.
Well, but the funny thing about it is that it actually is your mother's Ripley if your mother is Patricia Highsmith.
And your mother read the book.
She's mother. But, yes.
God, if she is mother, then I think that you've got some deep, deep trauma to work through. Yes, not to plug our own website too strongly or too obnoxiously, but our freelancer Rosemary Counter wrote a really great kind of summation of a bunch of Highsmith biographies and, you know, looked at her letters and talked to some of her biographers and even her publisher. And, like, Patricia Highsmith was a very twisted and dark and, you know, the classic example, I guess, of a great artist who makes great art and was very difficult and troubled and, you know, horribly racist and, just a very complicated and, like, mean kind of person who made these incredible thrillers, you know, not just this, but Strangers on a Train. Like, so I feel like the entire, like, modern thriller genre, I think, can really kind of be traced back to, you know, maybe like Agatha Christie and her.
Right, wow. Right, and lesbian fiction, too. Yeah. I mean, she was, great writer, bad person.
Yes.
That's interesting, because as someone who didn't read, who's never read her books or The Talented Mr. Ripley, wouldn't have gotten that necessarily from watching the original film.
Well, the original film is really, really different. I mean, it's not the original film, even. There were versions of Ripley before, adaptations of the book before the 1999 Anthony McKellar one, but that version, which I think for us, you know, modern audiences, is considered the definitive one. So that one is actually very different from the book. And this TV show, this series, is a lot closer to what she actually wrote.
Yeah. I think for me, the biggest difference between, other than aesthetics, between the 99 film and this show is I, four episodes in, am really not sure how sympathetic to Tom we're supposed to be. You know, like, he's not given this kind of soft, kind of pitiable quality that Matt Damon brought to the film, and I don't mind a totally different take on the material, but I'm still not sure how to read it yet, I guess.
It seems like the show admires him but doesn't like him, I think, which is definitely a different take. We shouldn't only be comparing this, I guess. We should also take it on its own merit, but, like, in the movie, which I also like recently rewatched, like he kind of kills Dickie by accident. It's a crime of passion. It's not premeditated in the same way.
It's emotional. I didn't rewatch the whole entire movie, but I rewatched that scene and the juxtaposition. It's really quite different. I would say that Andrew Scott's Ripley is sort of more of your classic sociopath who was methodical. He saw the ore. He takes it. He smashes Dickie in the head with it because...
I mean, I shouldn't say spoiler alert because you know we're going to talk about this, but... let's just get straight to the murder.
Let's just get straight to the murder because, I mean, I think that's the most... That's the big scene of the first four episodes, right? Whereas in the film, Matt Damon is hearing information for the first time. He really thinks that Dickie and him are in love. He's completely emotionally involved. He ends up cradling and
his
sort of
dead body.
His dead body. He's cuddling the dead body at the end. I'm pretty sure Andrew Scott rolls his eyes as he pushes Dickie into the sea, into the water. It's just a completely different take, which if you're going to remake something, why not go in a different direction? But I will say I was sort of shocked going back to the 1999 version about how much empathy and how we're supposed to sort of understand where Tom Ripley was coming from in murdering Dickie, which then it becomes sort of like a crime of passion, but then he gets attacked. Like, he sort of has to defend himself against Dickie.
And we're kind of mad at Dickie for making Tom do that.
Yes, which
is perverse, but like that's what the movie's doing. And the show... It frames, I mean, Dickie is supposed to be pretty interesting, kind of alluring, but he's not the golden god that Jude Law was playing. You know, Johnny Flynn is certainly not an ugly person by any means, but he has a more, I think he's just kind of framed a bit more like human scale. His painting is bad. Marge's book is maybe kind of dumb. You know, these people are not like demigods walking the earth. And so when we get to the murder scene, it really does feel much more like that is pure aggression coming from Tom, unwitting person. There's no even hint of parody in that situation.
And it does feel more motivated by a class consciousness than a love or an emotional connection. It's like Tom doesn't think Dickie's a good artist. He doesn't seem to really care that much about Dickie. He's jealous of the life that he has that he doesn't have.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The kind of romance is gone entirely in this version of the story, which, I mean, I agree with what you said before, too. Like, if you're going to make a new version of a story that people know really well, then, yeah, it makes a lot of sense to take a radically different approach.
Yeah, that being said, I do feel, and maybe it's because it's in black and white, maybe it's because it's so heavily stylized, there is a flatness with some of the like performances and some of the affect around it that is, because it's not as emotionally charged, because there's no romance, because there's no, you know, gorgeous Italy. I mean, it's still gorgeous in black and white, but we're missing that, the color, the pop that we get in the original version, that there is sort of a methodical, process-oriented flatness to everyone's performances that works for the show, but when revisiting the original, I was like, oh, it's a completely different
You're in love with
thing.
It.
Yes, you fall in love with it in a way that you're like fascinated. And this one is more fascination.
Despite the violence, you want to live in that movie.
Yes.
You don't want to live in this show.
Right. Because Tom wouldn't kill me. He'd be fine.
Not you.
No, I'm different.
Exactly. Pick me. No, it's true. I mean, the affect of the performances, they're muted, you know. That it took me a little while to kind of figure out that that was deliberate. And that maybe it wasn't that Zalian needed to do another take with like the energy turned up. Like it's purposeful.
Yeah.
But then you get this kind of a little bit more color through the Italian people. They when they're interacting with bank people and boat rental people. Like that's when I think there's a little more character emerging, which is kind of an interesting. I don't know if it always works, but it is an interesting way to view these expats versus the locals. But yeah, I think ultimately Zalian is not really asking us to get terribly invested in the human drama. It's more like, how does this guy work? How does he get away with it? Will he get away with it? And that's why we have this extended, almost comical boat scene where he dumps the body and then has to figure out what to do with the boat.
Yeah.
And it's zooming around on its own. Like
he gets hit in the head with a cinder block.
It's like
which is really, I mean, it's really interesting, too, because just as kind of Dickie and Marge are humanized, like, so is Ripley. I mean, if you focus that much on the process and, you know, just how tedious it is, how difficult it is, like, you do kind of see, like, I think it's really easy in a thriller to make the villain or, you know, the anti-hero or whatever you want to call him, like, some sort of impenetrable, like, immortal demon figure. But Tom is also human, which I think makes the series more interesting, too. Like, gives it another dimension by showing, yeah, like, if you kill somebody on a boat, like, what do you do next?
What,
like,
what
let's
do you do?
Let's spend 15 minutes figuring it out.
On a rented in a boat.
Yes.
And, like, we see Tom sink the boat, and that takes a whole amount of effort. He's throwing rocks in the thing. And then it finally gets into the water, and it sinks, and it's still kind of poking out of the water, and you're like, wait, Tom, that's not a, you
but
didn't do
like,
a good job.
I can't do it with the lighting. Like, I can't keep doing this.
I'm done. So it's like I think that right there is a mistake, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas Minghella in the film sort of eschewed a lot of that. Yeah. Just like, it happened off camera. Don't worry about it.
Whereas you get Amy Dunn in Gone Girl or something. Right. Like, mm-hmm. She has thought of every single possibility, every and she's like 12 steps ahead of everybody. And like, that's a very entertaining kind of character to read too. But like, I don't know. I think we've seen that kind of character more now, maybe just because this genre is so saturated that it's fun to go back to somebody who's a little less good at their job.
Yeah, but still, he still is read to be, or I think supposed to be perceived to be, as like hyper smart. I mean, he basically learned Italian and like by episode.
Well, he's
four.
A gifted mimic.
He's a gifted mimic. He's very like that. It came through.
He does a great Johnny Flynn impression.
Great, talented Mr. Ripley. The talent does come through in a different way. His sort of hyper intellect. But something that I found to be kind of funny or interesting was that it did feel like every single person that he meets is immediately suspicious of him from the jump.
Yep. And yet, somehow.
And yet he's like getting away with this, but they're all like, do you know that that Cola Scola video where they're like, they're doing a true crime thing?
Oh, yeah.
And they're like,
we're at the restaurant and I see him out of the corner of my eye dragging this dead horse through the whole restaurant. They didn't stop once. And I thought, okay, something is going on.
Something wasn't right there.
Something's not right.
Yeah. Not right. And everyone's like that with him.
You do meet him, and he is the most suspicious guy
immediately suspicious
in the world.
Yeah.
And everyone seems to know. Like, Marge, Dakota Fanning, like, immediately doesn't take to him.
Right. Whereas in the movie, Marge, for at least the first portion of the half the film, let's say, is like, I know Dickie can be this way, and she feels kind of bad for
him.
She's
welcoming him in,
But in this show, Marge is like, oh, no, I don't like this guy. I think it's an interesting way to bring Marge maybe a little bit more to the forefront of the story, at least in these first four episodes. Like, Marge is still very much, you know, hoping that Dickie will come back. We're sending him letters, knitting him a scarf that Tom very callously tosses off a bridge or whatever. I like her presence in this version, even if the scene on the sailboat in the movie where Marge says the thing about, like, you know, a cloud goes over the sun. And I'm like, I have felt that so many times. I love that moment. But it's okay to have a different sort of perspective. And yes, you're right. The suspicion is interesting, not just from her, but from basically everybody.
Every single person.
And you know, Dickie has that conversation with Tom, like saying, you know, I'm not queer.
Dickie, I feel sick about what just happened.
Look, let me just make this really clear. I'm not queer. I think you think I am.
I never thought you were.
Well, Marge thinks you are.
Why?
Well, if she were here to see what just transpired in there, then I'd say it was that. But since she wasn't, then I guess it must be something else.
Which is both more overt than in the film, but also, I don't think this show is as queer.
Yeah, no. It's not as interested in that at all.
He's certainly not in love with Dickie in the same way.
Mm-mm. No, he wants something that Dickie has, I guess. But also we see that, like, with the Paisley
the robe
that, like, he loves, but is sort of, you know, dismissed and mocked or whatever. Like, there's a class imbalance, there's a taste imbalance.
And he applauds those acrobats on the beach, and Dickie's like, what are you doing?
Well, that was pretty good.
That's kind of
the gayest he gets.
That's
though.
The gayest he gets, though, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, Patricia Highsmith, I think, did not think that Ripley was necessarily gay. I think that he's kind of just an asexual, you know, creature of ambition, maybe.
Right. Yeah. A creature is a good word. Yeah. I think he's sort of.
He's not enough of a person to have a sexuality.
Right. Right. Yeah. I guess then we just sort of. I ask, like, what does he seem to want in this? I mean, obviously he wants sort of entree into this kind of fabulous world, but why, you know?
Or his shithole apartment?
Well, yeah, sure, fair enough.
With that backed up drain, like, that was very visceral.
That stuff is rendered so well in the black and white, you know? I don't know. I think in the film you barely see any of Tom's life in New York. But yeah, I mean, I guess he wants to escape his station. But also maybe a lack of clear, like, readable psychological motivation is what makes him and why, yeah. and that's what makes him kind of frightening.
It's almost, it's weird that he was even sent on this mission in the first place.
Right, yeah, the very shadowy connection. Yeah, yeah.
Like, in the movie, in the 99 movie, there's an entirely different, like, backstory for why he wound up in Italy in the first place. And in the novel, he had actually met Dickie before he went to Italy, like, you know, through a friend of a friend
Bob
at DeLancey, a party or something.
Yeah, it's Bob DeLancey. I feel like that's got to be teased out in the second half of the the series. Like, why was he chosen? Who, this Bob DeLancey party, who is he? What is the connection there? Just because it is a little random.
I would say maybe set yourself up for disappointment. I don't know. Okay. I don't know if that's really going to be a focal point.
Oh, I would love. Now I am disappointed.
You want to know more?
Yeah, I do.
In the book, I mean, if you're curious, in the book there is some more about his childhood. Like when he tells Dickie's parents that his parents
drowned,
that his parents drowned. Like that is actually true. He was raised by his aunt Dottie, who you see him writing a letter to on the train.
And that crazy scene where she's just getting her teeth extracted just for fun.
Yep.
Yes.
Like, we don't really know why.
That. So she raised him. She never really loved him. She was, you know, kind of classic, cruel, you know, guardian who never considered him hers. And I think also, you know, assumed that he was gay and was homophobic about, you know, in a very mid-century sort of way. But so that is sort of the backstory there.
Mm-hmm. Right. We can infer, I guess, that he had to be a scrapper and figure out how to forge things and lie and all that stuff. And a lot of it seems to come naturally to him.
Yeah.
I mean, had he ever brokered a boat sale before? Probably not, but he figures it out.
Did it really well.
With the help of sort of shady...
But, I mean, he has also been at the petty crimes for longer because Andrew Scott is 45 years old.
Yeah, well, that's another thing, which is another slight qualm that I have, because Freddie, whoever's Freddie... can't be more than 19 years old. And so for them to be a sort of a friend group, and I would say Johnny Flynn Dickie is definitely skews older than our imagination or our...
Dakota Fanning is 30.
It's skewing
Johnny
older.
Flynn is 40.
Don't say that. That's the little child from Man on Fire. Yeah, I am Sam.
But I can totally see, especially if you're doing this sort of moody version of Talented Mr. Ripley, you being like, I want to pick somebody as far away from Philip Seymour Hoffman as possible, because no one's going to ever capture...
Because he's in that movie for like 2 minutes, but he's amazing in those 2 minutes.
Indelible and amazing. And watching this, I literally had to go back and I was like, is that the same character? There's no way that person's playing the same character. And they're doing wonderful work within the series, but just the stark difference is so stark in terms of the characterization of Freddie, but probably way more honest to, you know, an Italian, you know, a rich Italian person or a rich expat living in Italy than the 1999 version.
Yeah, so Elliot Sumner is the name of the actor who's playing Freddie Miles, child of Sting and Trudy Sarandon.
No, that's
what I was just looking up. I wanted to confirm that, but yeah.
That is correct.
Nepo.
What an interesting Nepo.
A great Nepo I mean,
that's a life that I would like to know about. That's a childhood I would like to know about.
Yeah, imagine... People have been making jokes about your parents' sex lives for 20 years.
Steven Zaillian has said Elliot Sumner was one of the only actors auditioning for this part who was not doing a Philip Seymour Hoffman impression. So maybe that kind of explains the approach.
Yeah,
love that.
Yeah, that's an interesting insight into the overall casting process for this, because something as indelible as that, like, how do you find something different? I guess you cast Ripley a bit older, you know, et cetera. You have the actors, you tell them to do something different.
Yeah. And you don't want a flamboyance, I guess. Although I feel like with the character of Freddie, I did miss that a little bit. You know, I feel like there should be kind of a larger than life, like rich kid in insouciance. Yeah.
It felt very high class, very rich, very upper crust, but understated in the way that a lot of, you know, high class rich people like to
be. I buy this Freddie being friends with this Dickie.
Yes.
I wouldn't buy Philip Seymour Hoffman's Freddie being friends with this Dickie. That's
totally.
Thing.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We took the stairs, too. Just there's so many stairs. So many shots of walking up and down stairs.
Okay, but here's the thing. In, like, towns like this, there are so many stairs.
That is true.
I have not been to, like, southern Italy. I have been to Croatia, and I will tell you that is a city of... That is Dubrovnik, city of stairs.
Didn't you see those viral TikToks of all those influencers who went to Italy, and they were like, there are too many stairs here.
There are.
And there's not enough water.
And I think the show also has a sense of humor, you know. Yeah. I think you mentioned Looney Tunes. Like, a little bit of a... When he goes all the way up just to have to go all the way down, just to have to go all the way up again. Like, I liked that. I thought that was kind of sly and kind of understated. Like, I like that it's not you know, you expect something to be kind of grim when it's mm-hmm. in black and white, you know, because of our own modern biases. But, like, this has a wit to it that I really enjoy.
And the stairs make sense, too. I mean, we meet Ripley having just murdered somebody with a body on the stairs. Mm-hmm. So seeing that him...
Be a motif, yeah.
Be a motif. It does make sense, but whew, I was there were a lot of them.
Well, he's left now at the end of episode four. He's left the there are fewer stairs, I think, in Rome. I mean, there are there are some
the Spanish steps.
Famous steps. Yeah.
They got a whole name.
And in some senses, I felt relief because I was like, okay, so he's out of the immediate scene of the crime. He's out of the stifling, you know, sort of closeness of the town that Marge is in. He's in a big city. He can kind of disappear, except that he can't because he needs access to money, but all, and he, so he needs to kind of keep pretending to be Dickie. Marge is looking for him, so he has to have these awkward conversations with hotel clerks about, like, hey, look, you know, I broke up with my fiance, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it's a gentle kind of suspense, but it is suspenseful, I find.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and it's not really even about that. I'm like, I care for this version of Ripley so much that I want him to get away. But it's, I don't know. I think it's just the show is built in such a way that it's like, I want to see the process work.
Yeah,
I guess.
Now, how is he going to get out of this one? Sort of element to the whole entire thing that obviously, I mean, we'll see by the end. Maybe he doesn't get out of it. But the way that he's able to use his wit and his, you know, hard scrabble scrappiness to outwit and outmaneuver these people who ostensibly have a lot more income and means and should absolutely be able to catch him is interesting, is definitely compelling. Though I will say, to only have that one shot of that gorgeous hotel room.
Oh, I know.
And then
them
kicking him out.
And he has to leave.
He has to leave. That was cruel.
He doesn't get a deluxe hotel. He doesn't have enough money to be throwing around on deluxe hotel rooms yet.
It really doesn't.
Yeah.
But that'll, maybe that changes.
there's more of a focus on money here. You know, mm-hmm. that's a big part of the movie too. But like this is, like Zalian is very careful to be like, no, like he can kind of check here or there. He can sell a boat, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But like there is not an unending stream of, he has to constantly be working for it. Which adds to the tension, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, the series You, which is also based on a book, is you know, very, very clearly indebted to, like, Patricia Highsmith and to Ripley specifically. And I like this as, you know, kind of the original version of that, where, yeah, he just keeps on murdering people. He keeps on painting himself into a corner. He has to find a way out. He uses his wit. He has a lot of luck. and that will certainly come into play, too. But, yeah, And that's, you know, that's on Netflix, too. I wonder if the audience for that will tune into this and what they will think of it. It's certainly a less flashy show.
Yeah.
Yes, that's for sure. And, you know, originally this was a Showtime series that they decided not to air, and so Netflix bought it. But it does, you're right, fit comfortably alongside one of their biggest hit shows. So, that, you know, it's funny. I was getting a drink with a friend before a show. We were going to see An Enemy of the People with Jeremy Strong. Mm-hmm. And the host, he was taking us to our table. And he was like, what are you boys seeing tonight? And I was like, oh, we're seeing, I forget the title. It's with, you know, Jeremy Strong from Succession. And he was like, I don't know who that is. And I was like, oh, it's called Enemy of People. He was like, oh, with the girl from You.
Wow.
And I was like, ah, okay. So Gen Z has a different.
That is a whole category of person.
That is a whole.
Yeah. I was like, that was fascinating. Anyway,
she was good in the play.
Yeah, they probably know who Elliot Sumner is, too.
That's right. Yeah. So we have, I think, you know, four more episodes of scrambling to look forward to. Will he get out of it? Sadly, we're not going to get a Venetian romance with Peter Smith Kingsley, doomed as that is in the film. There will be no Meredith Logue, played by Cate Blanchett in the film, which is a shame. But I think that Zalian sets up enough in these four episodes and also crucially takes us to a new location that it feels like it has gas for the back.
Yeah, no, this show does not feel baggy to me. Like, it takes its time. It feels measured. It doesn't feel bloated, which is so often, you know, the case with streaming stuff. Maybe less so now than kind of when streaming was new, and it just seemed like everybody wanted to make something into 10 episodes that should have been a movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, like, this does not feel like it should have been a movie. I think
it already was a movie, even.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, because it wants to take that time.
Yeah.
It wants to show you process. It wants to show you, oh, you have to sink the boat. But the first attempt doesn't work, and, you know, et cetera. So, like, yeah, I think it feels efficient without feeling rushed.
No, totally.
Yeah.
It feels kind of luxurious the way that it spends so much time on all of these, like, little details without feeling, like, indulgent.
Well, we look forward to the next four, then.
Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, a conversation with Dakota Fanning, who plays Marge Sherwood.
Thank you. You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
So we love watching Tom Ripley. Would you like to hang out with Tom Ripley?
I absolutely would not want to hang out with Tom Ripley, but you know who did hang out with him? Dakota Fanning. She took on the role of Marge Sherwood, Dickie's girlfriend who didn't exactly care for Tom Ripley and did not try to hide it. I caught up with her while she was on a break filming in Canada to go all the way back to the Italian coast and relive her Ripley experience. Enjoy the conversation. Wow. Oh my gosh. Dakota Fanning, thank you so much for stopping by the podcast. I gotta know, stepping into Ripley, right? This is a beloved property from the book to the movie. What was your relationship like with the talented Mr. Ripley before jumping onto this project?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. First of all, my relationship with it was, I was familiar with the characters, familiar with the material, and, you know, wasn't jumping in totally blind, but it was very clear from the beginning that, you know, Steve Zalian's version was going to be a very faithful adaptation to, you know, the Patricia Highsmith novel. And you were also going to just get to go much more in depth with the character simply because of the, you know, 8-episode series format. And I know that was the big draw for him of wanting to tell the story, was being able to have that time to spend with Tom Ripley, especially, but with everyone. And so I was excited. And when I read the scripts, I read them so quickly that I remember thinking, if I email Steve back now, he's never going to believe that I read them all.
Really? Okay. So you tore through them.
A very fast reader as it is. But this was next level. And I was like, I think you need to wait like an hour or two before you respond.
Don't text back too fast. You got to play it cool.
For believability. Even though I had read them, I was like, he's just not going to believe you.
Oh, that is so fantastic. Wow. I mean, I love this sort of new Ripley, especially someone who was, you know, knew the talented Mr. Ripley from the 1998 film. This is completely different. You know, it's black and white. It's macabre. It's highly stylized. It is just a completely different vibe. Did that influence your take on Marge at all? Or how did sort of the aesthetics of this version influence your acting choices?
Yeah, I think it influenced it a lot. I think, you know, I was a huge fan of the film and loved the film, but we were doing something different. And I think when you see the first frame, it kind of becomes clear that it's something different, you know?
Yeah.
So there was no pressure for any of us to compare ourselves to anyone else or any other performance or anything. And thank goodness.
Yeah.
and yeah, I think it was its own thing. And so I was really happy with that. And, you know, this Marge is totally suspicious of Tom from the very beginning. And so I had a lot of fun being able to kind of modulate that suspicion and figure out where it kind of waxes and wanes, and servicing this version of the story. You know, it was Marge is kind of one of the only characters that's pretty suspicious of Tom from the start, and also meets him in episode 1 and is still dealing with him in episode 8.
Yeah, she makes it all the way.
She makes it all the way. And I loved getting to kind of play with Marge's own opportunism a little bit, which I don't know that has ever been seen before with Marge, that, you know, she kind of, I don't know, weirdly maybe sees a little bit of herself in Tom, or Tom sees a little bit of himself in her. You know, we learned that Marge is from Minnesota, so she's kind of a small town girl that maybe doesn't come from the wealth that Dickie comes from. And so she's kind of, you know, figuring out her place in all of it too, in a less murderous way than Tom. Yeah. But
yes, that must be said. Shavin, there,
but,
yes.
but nonetheless, I think they're that weirdly, they kind of see a weird little piece of themselves in each other, and perhaps that's why they dislike each other so much right from the start. And how Marge's vanity sometimes gets in her way a little bit. Tom kind of uses that to ingratiate himself with her, and she kind of falls prey to that at times, as we all do, you know? Yeah. I think that's a very human trait to, when somebody compliments you, you go, oh, well, maybe they're not so bad after all.
Yeah, that's all it takes. It's really literally all it takes.
Which I think is quite human. And playing with all of that. And again, being able to play with all of that because we had more time.
Yeah, I love what you sort of honed in on, Marge being from Minnesota, Marge also being a little bit of a striver a la Tom, you know, this class consciousness, right, with Dickie, you know, sort of being, you know, the Mr. Moneybags, and Marge also living a nice life, but that aspect of it really came through in Ripley with Marge and Tom and their sort of immediate distaste for one another. That sort of game recognized game sort of a thing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think, you know, I think a lot of Tom's, you know, he sees these people that he feels have access to the beauties of the world, whether it be, you know, art, travel, you know, the access that they have to the things that he appreciate so much, and he, you know, sees them not appreciating them in the way that he deems, you know, proper. So and I think it's extra frustrating that someone like Marge, who wasn't perhaps born into that world, is getting to reap the benefits of the world, and why, you know? Why her?
Yeah. No, I mean, and that makes a ton of sense. And then also, I mean, Marge is also complicated too, because she's got that aspect, but then she's also kind of a dilettante like Dickie, right? Dickie's got his painting, he's not great at it. Marge needs a lot of help with her book. And that is a really kind of fascinating scene between you and Andrew Scott, where Marge sees Tom in a different way after he just rips through and edits her book. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, that moment?
Yeah, sure. Well, Marge writing her book is, you know, kind of a through line for the whole series. Yeah. And that is, you know, sort of probably predicated on a lie, you know, because Tom says he worked at Random House. And it's also quite human to, you know, you hear what you want to hear. You know, she doesn't ask any more questions about that. She just accepts that he did work at Random House with no further, you know, no further.
People really let him go off with no explications. They really just take his word for it.
Because that's something that is going to serve her, you know? So it's like she doesn't want to ask too many questions about that because she wants to believe that that's true and reap some sort of benefit from it. He goes through her book and she accepts his criticism and his harshness with that, whereas she's more wary to accept his criticism and harshness of other things. And I think that also shows, you know, Marge takes her book very seriously, and Marge takes her writing very seriously, and takes you know, photography very seriously. And so there's, as much as Marge is a very shrewd character who's kind of very discerning with Tom, I think there's also a very kind of pure naivete to her as well, whether it's kind of accepting that, you know, his sort of faux criticism of her book. You know, he's kind of just trying to be as mean as possible about it, you know, or some, or just to, mm-hmm. to make sure she knows that her book needs a lot of work.
Yeah, but, he's not very nice about it.
Yeah, but there's kind of this, you know, naive quality. And I think that, you know, you see that a little bit throughout the series, that sort of peek through. And I think, you know, ultimately that is probably highlighted the most by that she really does love Dickie. You know, that's not, it's not totally, she's not a complete opportunist in that way. I think it is, it does stem from something actually kind of pure. And that sort of broke my heart too. You know, it's, and that's sort of the cunning nature of Tom, that he, even the person that sort of does have him figured out, Marge, can't quite get there because he's just so many steps ahead mentally. Even when he makes mistakes kind of physically, you know, he's not a perfect killer. He's not a natural born killer. He's not bloodthirsty. Yeah. It's all kind of, he has to, you know, quote unquote, he feels that he has to do these things, but he's not perfect in that way, but mentally outsmarting him just seems like an impossibility, even for somebody like Marge, who sort of seemingly had his number quite quickly.
I would love to know, what was it like working with Andrew Scott and Johnny Flynn? I mean, I'm sure Italy is a terrible place to be to film, right?
Yes. No, it was one of the most exciting parts about knowing I was going to be in this was obviously the beautiful locations and the cities that we got to spend time in. It was definitely isolating at times just because, you know, it was a long shoot and we were in a lot of places during the off season, just like the characters are, you know, so it wasn't exactly the Amalfi Coast that you picture. It was for at the beginning, and then it sort of, you feel when the season changes and when things start to close and when everyone starts to go home and all of that. It was very interesting. And, you know, kind of it was the time that the characters were supposed to be in these towns, so it was quite helpful. But I just love Andrew and Johnny so very much. Andrew is just such a great person and friend and such a brilliant actor. I was so excited to work with him every time and to just see what he was going to do that day. You know, he's so unlike Tom Ripley, obviously, in real life. Most actors are usually unlike their characters. But
yeah, I would hope so.
That's not a crazy thing to say. But
I'm happy to hear that, though. That's nice.
He's so warm. You know, he's not just, oh, he's nice. He's so warm. He's so kind of playful, funny, all those things. So it was quite a shift to see him in this character each day. So that made it so fun. And then Johnny is also the same. I think he brings that to Dickie, gentle quality, a very sweet quality. There's a scene in one of the first few episodes where I have been, you know, left at dinner and he's forgotten to come meet me for dinner because he's been, you know, hanging with Tone.
I'm sorry, I forgot. Come on, let's go.
They were closing when I left.
Oh, did you eat? You want some prosciutto? We got cheese, okay, olive. You want to see the room we fixed up?
Maybe later.
Sorry.
The moment where he says he's sorry to me, it was like, bro, it was so true. It wasn't just, you know, Johnny could have played Dickie very dismissive in that moment and like, who cares? You know, I'm sorry, I forgot.
Totally.
And it was such a just gentleness and like a genuine apologetic quality when he said that I was sorry. It like broke my heart, you know, like as the person. And I love that Johnny brought that to Dickie, and you know, it's not just a shock when he's killed and in the like in that way, but there's a sadness too, a deep sadness that I at least feel when I watch it, you know, because I think he just brought a gentleness to him that I hadn't seen before. So working with both of them was so incredible. Andrew obviously had so much on his shoulders with this and was really, you know, working on it for almost a year, about a year. And, you know, he's in nearly every scene. And so in the times that you know, we could be social and go have dinner or have a drink, or we definitely took advantage of those moments. However, few and far between they felt sometimes.
Yeah, no, I can imagine.
Yeah, but I just love them both dearly, and it was so. I can't imagine. It was so fun going on this journey with them. I can't imagine it with anyone else.
Well, it's such an incredible journey. I'd be remiss if I didn't say, I mean, I've been a fan of yours. I feel like I've known you since I was a kid, because you've been, since you were a kid, because you've been working for so long and have been in so many amazing projects. I'd love to know, you know, for having been in this industry, which can chew people up and spit people out so easily, so quickly, how do you stay emotionally attached and excited and keep things fresh in Hollywood after being in it for so long?
Yeah. Well, I don't know exactly.
That's a good answer. No,
you just do. And I mean, sometimes you go through different periods of feeling about it. You know, I mean, I've been working since I was 6 years old, and I just turned 30, and so...
Happy birthday.
Thank you. You go through different emotions, and you have times where you're more excited about things, and then you go through a period of kind of feeling like, oh, I need to change it up, or I've been working too much, I need to not... You know, I mean, you just feel all different kinds of things, but I think as long as the root is that you love what you're doing, as cliche and kind of boring as that sounds, I just think it's true. I don't know how to describe it any other way, that even during the moments of feeling down, or moments of, you know, whether it be rejection or whatever it is, you know, periods of negative emotions, if the root is still that you love what you're doing and you can't imagine doing anything else, then you're kind of in the right place, and you just it's a adventure that ebbs and flows. And I think once you give into that, I think I've learned that you can't hold on to anything too tightly, you know, like you have to kind of be fluid and know that if this is going to be your life and your career, then you have to kind of ride the wave of it, and also really value the experience just as much as the reception of a project, you know, because the experience is a part of your life. You know, it's like, those are days of my life I can't get back making this, for example, you know, so it can't all be hung up on, what do people think? Do people like it? Do people watch it? Of course that's exciting when that happens, and really, it is also quote unquote important, but that's been the last week, for example, you know, making this was like 9 months of my life, you know, that was my precious life, you know.
Your one and only life, one life that you have. Yeah.
So I put just as much, if not more, value on, you know, the experience and the process. Because that's, you know, time spent and time everyone can't get back. And so, you know, and also the relationships that you make, you know, sometimes things go well, or things don't go the way that you thought they were going to go, or whatever, but you're kind of left with the experience and left with the friendships and the memories and all of that. So put a lot of importance on that. And I think that kind of also helps keep you rooted
and grounded,
grounded throughout my years.
that's so cool. And I mean, and grounded, that's so important, and that's such an important, you know, quality to have. And I know you said, and this is so fair, I'm sort of like gonna ask, you were like, oh, like you can't focus too much on the reception. Have you been paying attention this last week? Because people have been really taking to Ripley. Like, have you been paying attention?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I've been paying a little bit of attention to it. I get very excited about the people in my life watching it, you know, because it's hard to describe an experience sometimes to friends or family, or it takes quite a bit of time for things to come out usually. So I've been so excited for like my mom to watch it, you know, like my best friends, like to kind of get a little bit of a vibe of what I was meaning when I was describing my experiences filming, you know, kind of as close as they'll ever get to being there is watching it. So I've been really excited by that and really happy that people are enjoying it. And it really was every single person, every crew member, every cast member, no matter how big or small their role or job was, made this what it is. You know, it took an incredible amount of time, energy, devotion, passion from every single person. And when I watch it, and I think when other people are watching it, they're seeing that, you know, and Steve as a writer and as a director is incredibly detailed, and nothing is a big scene. Nothing is a small scene. Everything is kind of given the same weight, which in the moment, sometimes you're like, you've just been filming my fingers writing a letter all day. I mean, you know,
there's a lot.
But you know, in the moment, you're like, well, it's, you know, there's a reason for this. It'll make sense. And when I watch it and I just see the details and the small things, it just bolsters the big things so much more. And I think that's Steve's real gift as a director. I think we know about his gift as a writer, you know, and as a director, he just treats everything with equal importance, which is so rare these days. I think, you know, when you work on things, it's constantly, you hear a lot of times like, oh, we'll fix it later. We'll do it in post, or don't worry about that. That's not important. Or we're never going to see that, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, I'm sure they, you know, there were things that were done in post and things that were fixed in post and things, whatever. But that was very rarely said. You know, it was really about getting everything as perfect as possible, practically making this. And I really feel kind of honored that I got to kind of witness that level of passion from everyone and to be a part of that.
Well, that attention to detail and that passion really shines through, and it's really such a phenomenal project, and you are so wonderful in it. And this has been such a treat. It's so great to chat with you, and I can't thank you enough for coming and stopping by the podcast, Dakota.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Still Watching will return in a moment, and we're talking travel tips for murderers on the run in Italy.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So I don't want to step on the toes of the podcast Women Who Travel, which is, you know, also a Condé Nast production. But I'm a woman and I would like to talk about traveling. I feel like, you know, as we said, this version of Italy maybe doesn't seem like the most welcoming place in the world.
A lot of cloudy days in this.
Yes. Yeah. You know, all the beaches are very moody. There's nobody on them. But I still think that, you know, you watch something like this set in like a gorgeous somewhere else sort of location, and it does kind of awaken that in you, like the urge to travel. So like what sorts of travel tips do you think we can kind of glean from Ripley or
I mean, I think as Chris mentioned the stairs earlier, I have
you do cardio before
I
you go.
I often make the mistake of thinking I need to get cute little new like boat shoes or whatever to wear in, you know, can or when I go for work. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, I didn't break these in and my feet are dead by the second day, you know?
And the cobblestones so, everywhere, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's always going to be a little hotter than you think it is, even though this show doesn't make it seem very hot.
Well, it is the fall into the winter. So
no, that's true.
Traveling on the off season is a good tip.
That is a good tip. That is, you know, smart. And I think maybe Southern Italy has been a bit more discovered than it was 70 years ago.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
But you know, maybe just go further south. Go down to Sicily.
I guess. Feel like post pandemic, every person that I've ever met in my life went to Italy. I don't know why it was Italy specifically.
Yeah, Stanley Tucci maybe.
Yeah,
maybe. Is he to blame?
Yeah, in the pandemic, he was making all of those drinks and talking about Italy. And he's
yeah,
like,
yeah, I watched that show a lot during the pandemic.
Maybe that was
really,
why.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I think that Tom is smart to buy out an entire train car so that he can have some privacy to do his scheming.
Yeah,
if he can afford it.
Yeah, if you can get six seats, then do it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, I will say, re-drinks. They don't really have Diet Coke in Europe. It's really Coke Zero and Coke Light. So you got to.
Isn't Coke Light the same thing as Diet Coke?
It's a little bit different. Tastes a little bit different. Yeah. It's not exactly the same.
And some places in Europe will have exclusively Coke Zero. Others will have exclusively Coke Light.
Mm-hmm.
Some will have, very few have both. But I do like the focus on ice because still 70 years later, ice is a tricky thing in Europe. It's very hot here, guys. Could we please
not
maybe have...
Buy.
The focus on the buying the fridge is also, I liked, there was a whole episode kind of about that.
It keeps you locked.
Big deal.
The terrible domesticity of owning a fridge.
So if you're going to Italy, bring your own fridge, is what we're saying.
Yeah, it fits into a carry-on.
Yeah. Well, like a Casper mattress.
Yeah.
If you want to learn more about the Ripley novels and the many other adaptations of Patricia Highsmith's classic books, head over to the Critics at Large podcast from our friends, The New Yorker. You can get Critics at Large from The New Yorker wherever you get your podcasts.
So that does it for this episode of Still Watching. If you're watching along, now is the time to binge episodes 5 through 8 of Ripley. We'll be back on Sunday with the final part of our 2-part series.
And where can we find you, Richard?
Oh, sorry.
If you are, in fact, Richard Lawson.
Yeah, if you're not Tom Ripley.
Between now and then, you can find me on social media at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me at Chris Triss.
And you can find me at Hillabuster with 2 R's. This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we have production help from Peyton Hayes. We were engineered and mixed by Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday, April 14th, for part 2 of our special Ripley coverage. Looking forward to seeing you then.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.